This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Hey there, welcome to today's Positive Parenting Show. I'm Armin Brott. You know, if there's one ingredient essential to healthy development, it's the connection between parent and child. Ultimately, it's that parent-child bond that shapes the child's sense of self. Babies really have no sense of who they are on an independent level. Instead, they develop their sense of self from the reflection that they see mirrored in their relationship with their parents or earliest caregivers. From the manner in which caregivers touch, attune, or connect with an infant, those infants slowly blossom into beings with growing senses of who they are. Paradoxically, the greater the interconnectivity between parent and infant, the greater the autonomy will be later on in life when that child grows up. And there is no place where that parent-child connection is better shown off than in the way that we dance with our babies. We instinctively rock a baby back and forth to music. Hey, if there's no music available, we create it by humming or singing. Being held while dancing and simultaneously being exposed to music provides a rich environment for infants. But because dancing with babies is so simple and so instinctive, we probably don't even know how important it is. But in this part of today's show, we're going to find out exactly how important it is with my guest, who is an anthropologist and an expert in dancing with babies. So get ready to rock right after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
You must be your fairy godmother. Yes.
It doesn't take a fairy godmother to tell you that the right fit means everything.
Good heavens, child. You can't go in that.
Children under 4'9" need to be in a booster seat because they aren't ready for adult safety belts alone. Remember that 4'9" is the magic number. And get your little pumpkin there safely in a booster seat.
Oh, thank you.
For more information, visit boosterseat.gov. This has been a message from the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Sue Doherty, who is the author of Dancing with Your Baby. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's talk about, just generally speaking, the whole idea of dancing with your baby. I mean, I think that's something that parents probably do without even really thinking about it.
Well, that's right. It's probably an impulse that they're feeling from deep from our evolutionary history, and it's a natural thing to do. As soon as you have a baby in your arms, you seem to tend to want to rock them, and they respond
accordingly. And accordingly being that they calm down.
They calm down, right.
Okay.
And much more if you're standing up. If you're sitting down holding a baby, they're not quite as comfortable. As soon as you stand up, it's been shown that they will calm down even more so.
You think it's the standing, or is it that you have more mobility that way?
I think it's mobility and the motion.
Yeah.
Rocking itself has been, activates a system that's vital to their development, the cerebellum in the back of the brain. So motor systems and nervous system is dependent on that rocking motion. And it's also reminiscent of the womb experience.
Just being rocked around while you're,
yes,
while your mother's walking around doing stuff. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And then when you add the music, it's a whole other dimension. So.
Well, that's another part. So how does the music fit in? I mean, is that a necessary part of it? Do you need to have that?
Well,
or
it's definitely
not necessary. Silently?
It's not necessary. Babies have the capacity to hear beat. Already by 6 months of age or so, they have beat induction, so they recognize when a beat is missing in rock music, say drum-infused rock music. They start deciphering pitch, melody, and rhythm, even in the womb. At 20 weeks as a fetus, they can start hearing these sounds, and even so much that when they are born, their cries imitate the same qualities and characteristics. So that pitch, so a German baby cries like a German, et cetera. So,
well, and they tend to prefer that. I mean, I know that there have been a lot of studies about kids who are brand new babies who are presented with recordings of somebody speaking in their whatever speech their mother, whatever language their mother spoke, or somebody else, and they generally pick the one that their mother spoke. So they're familiar with those things. I'm curious, though, you mentioned about they can identify or they can, whatever, they could suffer or something from a missing beat.
Yes.
How do we know that?
Well, there have been enough people studying music's ability to affect the brain now, and David Levitin is being one of them. And he's out of McGill University. Daniel. I'm not sure that he's the one that actually did that study, though. I believe it was someone in Europe, and I can't recall the name.
No, it's okay.
Daniel recommends that you have the baby exposed to as much different music as possible so that they will not show such a preference. If you want them to be exposed to many different genres of music and appreciate them. But the main thing is when the baby is born and you are dancing, that the music is something that they like. And when it's liked, whether you like it, it has to be liked by you.
By at least somebody, yeah.
Well, it will naturally benefit our immune system if we like the music. So if the baby likes the music, it will improve their immune system, and likewise for us. But this dance definitely needs to be infant-directed. In other words, if the baby doesn't like the music, you shouldn't be doing it. If they don't like the position of the carriage of the hold you're doing, it's not recommended that you carry on and do it. This is definitely an awareness situation that the caregiver needs to be sensitive to their needs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I think that's something that I think a lot of parents don't pay that much attention to. You figure, I'm going to do this. I want to do it. I want to read the whole story. And the kid's showing clear signs. If you pay attention, they're turning the other way. They're fussing, whatever. And so we have to, as parents, understand that means no.
Absolutely.
And we have to understand that no means no sometimes.
That's a vital point.
Yeah.
We don't learn very well when we don't like something. You know, when we haven't chosen to pay attention to it ourselves, we probably won't learn very much.
Yeah. So you talked about music and about the movement. Is there anything else that's especially engaging to kids about dancing?
Well, the most important aspect of this is sensory integration. So this is just coming on board to where we're paying enough attention to this matter. But when we take in information in our senses, we need sensory and motor stimulation in order to develop our brain and nervous system. And that has to be integrated so that all the systems can work in coordination. When you get information from multiple stimuluses, you end up learning easier so that your brain passes this sort of threshold where learning can take place when the information comes in a multimodal situation. So when you're holding a baby, you've got the touch going on, and then you've got the dance, you've got the movement, then you've got the sound. Hopefully you're singing or talking now and then. You're doing the visual stimulus where you're either developing gaze in their eyes or turning them outward to face somewhere else to look, and which they often like so much more.
Yeah.
Actually, the posture of a baby is really important also. They have shown that facing outward allows them to learn and develop concepts of different objects if they're in close enough proximity to that object.
Right.
So.
No, I've heard that. There was Norma Radin, I think, was a researcher years ago in Michigan. I think she died quite a while ago, but mm-hmm. had speculated that kids who get thrown around by their fathers in particular, who are playing more physically, tend to be better at math. And the reason why is because while they're up in the air, they're looking at objects from many different sides and getting different perspectives. Mm-hmm. And so that's an important part of certainly of geometry, but also of other kinds of math, mm-hmm. that to be able to see something and imagine what it's going to be like on the other side. So it's interesting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Well, and all this plays into attention and self-regulation, you know, how the baby develops, I mean, for the social aspect of it all, the emotional intelligence and social empathy, attention, joint attention. And joint attention has been shown to benefit from multimodal stimulation that's also dynamic. And
when you say joint attention, you mean the parent and the baby looking at the same thing at the same time?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So that develops about 9 to 12 months of age, say. So first they're going to start attending to things themselves. But when they can follow what you are paying attention to, that is a much more complex proposition for them. And so this, when stimulation is coming in many different modalities, that will aid the process and develop that.
Don't really even think about that. It's a difficult concept. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can see if you remember back to when your kids were babies, you know, there's a point where when you point at something, mm-hmm. they look at your finger for a long time.
Yes.
And then after a while, probably around the time you're talking about, around a year or so, they start looking at where you're pointing.
Yes.
Which is a really sophisticated leap to make.
It is.
You know, dogs have trouble mm-hmm. with that.
Very.
Yeah.
And as you see children mature, you see. I've worked with special needs of various ages from kindergarten through high school, and the self-regulation, the impulse control that is lacking, and you can see it tied into spatial awareness and coordination. They don't have the same integrated sensory integration, and somehow it has affected this capacity to even self-regulate. And this is, these are critical things to get ahead and to focus and to continue to learn and remember and make proper decisions. And
talking with Sue Doherty, who is the author of Dancing with Your Baby, and we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Sue about dancing with babies.
Ever notice when you have a baby, everyone seems to give you advice? From your mother-in-law, to your own parents, to your friends. But when it comes to the important stuff, like immunizations and protecting my baby's health, I trust my baby's doctor. She really listens to my questions about shots, gives me great information, and she works with me to make sure my baby gets protected. And that's something even my mother-in-law can agree with.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Sue Doherty, who is the author of Dancing with Your Baby. And I want you to talk a little bit, Sue, about what the goal of all this is. I mean, certainly there's something to be said for just spending time with your baby and connecting and having moments where you're doing something together. You're getting used to the baby gets used to you. But, I mean, are there claims that people are making, and I know that you're not going to be making them yourself, but you know, that people are making about, well, if you dance with your baby, then you're going to have a child who's going to do better on the SATs or, you know, things like that. Is there something like that out there, or is there just general less ridiculous goals?
Well, one of the more interesting studies that recently came out, probably about a year ago, from McMaster University, showed that when you dance in sync to music with a baby, that they will be more pro-social. And what they did was that the researchers had 14-month-old babies in a front carrier and danced either in sync or out of sync to music. And then that was done, and they acted as if the researchers were doing laundry and hanging clothes on the line, and they dropped a clothespin. And the babies that were danced in sync to music were much more apt to go and pick up the clothespin and hand it to the researcher. And the babies that danced out of sync actually walked away.
Really?
Yes. Yes. And this is Laurel Cirelli out of McMaster's University.
That's
about
fascinating.
A year ago.
Yeah, I had heard about studies like that, but I didn't realize that the connection was dancing in there.
Mm-hmm.
And how long does that effect last? I mean, if you dance for 20 minutes, I mean, is it just something that's immediately right after, or is that these kids grow up to be Mother Teresa?
That's a good question. Maybe we need to keep watching these children. Empathy can, the more we pay attention to be mindful with our parenting or caregiving, I think our children will do the same accordingly and will know how to be empathetic. And, well, that's also been tied into attention and aspects that we've discussed earlier. But, yeah, we can only hope that things like that happen. But I would, yes.
I mean, it's as somebody who's obsessed with research, it's fascinating to the figure out where these things come from and where they go.
Mm-hmm.
is awfully interesting. And then there's also the part that we haven't really talked about that much, which is the benefit to the parent.
Yes, right.
And the stress reduction, but also, besides the getting to know your baby part, but there are some benefits to us. What are those? Talk about those a little bit.
Okay, well, definitely the stress reduction. I was a very active person before I had children. I loved to doing sports and whatnot. And so I found that my babies definitely wanted to be held a lot of the time. And I wasn't particularly a dancer, but I loved music. And I went to a friend's class who's a movement therapist, and she suggested doing this. And it was so beneficial for both of us. And I got a workout. Babies are heavy. They get heavier
the older they
get. And which is, Armin, I'm glad that we're discussing this here with fathers, because you're probably going to end up lifting that baby up a little easier than, petite moms. Like, I was pretty petite. If my husband was dancing, he'd be able to do it longer. He's just going to lift those pounds a little easier. But, you actually do get a workout. Paying attention to your muscle mass is a good thing, as aerobic as you want to be. And as the baby matures, they like it. The more physical you can get, the better,
Yeah, they do like that. And they're very good about recognizing when mom is there or when dad is there, and they mm-hmm. respond differently. And they'll do the quieter or mm-hmm. less physically active stuff with mm-hmm. it with mom, and they'll expect to be mm-hmm. jostled a lot more with dad.
Right, right.
And having both of those is a good mm-hmm. thing for them. Yeah.
then there's also the yoga and tai chi that I suggest because I think it's very beneficial to make sure that you quiet yourself and make sure you're mindful and stretching in that manner. I like to think that yoga is more than stretching, but it does allow you to do that. And flexibility and whatnot is certainly good for us. So all in all, it's just a great way to release a little bit of stress and get a little bit of workout and then have extra time on the other end because your baby is completely satisfied. Mine fell asleep easily. Any baby I've been around that I danced with just played easier when you mm-hmm. were finished with the activity. They were satisfied.
How did you get into this?
Well, like I mentioned, I went and saw a friend after my first baby was about 4 months old. She's a movement therapist, and she just suggested it. And I came home and just started doing it, and I was so utterly convinced after the first one. And then, of course, then I had a second baby, and I just was really fascinated by the whole thing. I went and got a master's in anthropology because I wanted to learn a little bit more
about dancing.
Well, about the human condition, about human development, and I like the anthropological perspective of how it looks at all the different aspects, whether it's cultural, physical, evolutionary, linguistic, even archaeology, which is evolutionary perspective as well. But yeah.
So aside from the things that we've talked about paying attention to cues about it's time to stop or time to tone it down anyway, mm-hmm. what other guidelines can you give us? And we talked a little bit about having a variety of different types of music, but are there other better ways to incorporate dance into you and your baby's life than others?
Well, I think the bottom line is that the baby likes what you're doing. So pay attention to any signals about how you're holding the baby or is emotion. Oftentimes they want to look outward, or if they're colicky, they might even like being held like an airplane motion, like a flying motion where they're on their belly and resting on your hands rather than over the heart embrace. That might be too confining for some babies. Music can be too loud and too stimulating for some. And it depends on the time of day, what type of music you're choosing, what type of mood.
Do you recommend making it a regular practice at a specific time, or try to fit it in at a regular time?
Well, that might be an idea that's worthwhile. If your baby tends to like schedules, or if it's working out for you. But spontaneity is the name of the game, I think, in child rearing, where you're just flexible. You try to be open to what's happening and what their needs are. I think ritualizing it and trying to do it every day would be great. I think it's probably the most age-appropriate play you can do with an infant, and based on evolutionary necessities. I think our brains need that rocking motion, which also helps them facilitate sleep, and us as well. That's why we like hammocks. It helps put us to sleep.
Yeah, I've never been in a hammock for more than a couple of minutes. I just found them really uncomfortable.
Well, yes.
I don't know. Well,
that's
I don't like steam baths either, or jacuzzis anyway either. So that's
yeah.
Who knows?
To each
who knows what that
know.
Means? Yeah. So, bottom line, we only have just a couple seconds left. So, what's your nutshell about this thing? You know, do it. You want to keep your expectations in line, or what's this quick summary of the whole thing?
Well, there's a whole cognition in itself, that way we end up knowing things. That involves attention and memory and judgment, problem solving, decision making. All that is actually needs this sort of sensory integration and multimodal approach to development. And there's this whole paradigm shift in neuroscience that says that cognition isn't about models of the world. It's not concepts in your head. It's grounded in sensory coupling. It's this a skillful activity that involves ongoing interaction with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we're talking about here, is really a dynamic way of living and being in the world, is what our brains need to be good learners and empathetic caregiving individuals.
Great. Okay. Sue Doherty, the author of Dancing with Your Baby. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
My name is Ruth Roosie, and this is how I live United. I read to children as part of United Way's education program. It helps them create links between language and literacy and prepares them for a better academic future. I figure I have the time and they have the need. My name is Ruth Russi. I help kids prepare to succeed in school. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org, brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brandt, and it's time for a Parents at Play segment. You know, after a long day of having fun outside, which is what you probably ought to be doing this time of year, it's important still to have some downtime, relaxing time. And here are a number of games that we're pretty sure that your family is going to love to do inside. First one's called Cash Out. It's by Simply Fun. So each player is a fund manager who's got the goal of building a diversified, balanced, high-yield portfolio. The goal, of course, is to cash out with the most points. Along the way, you're buying and selling and strategizing. Cash out is a fun way to introduce your child or yourself to some very basic investment concepts before he or she starts playing around with that college fund. It takes about 20 to 30 minutes to play for 2 to 4 players age 10 and up. Costs $24, and you can get it at simplyfun.com. Compose Yourself is from Think Fun. Every once in a while, a game comes along that is completely unique, and Compose Yourself is really one of those games. So you open up the box, and you find 60 transparent coded music cards. Each one has got imprinted on it a musical staff and 4 beats worth of notes. So the cards are transparent, which means you can arrange them in each of 4 different ways. There's like the front, the back, and then upside down both ways. And there's nothing that can indicate whether there's a right side or a wrong side, so there really isn't. So now's the fun part. You string together any 4 cards to create a unique composition. There are apparently a billion possibilities. Then you go to the Compose Yourself website, enter the codes that are on the cards, and you'll hear your composition played by a full symphony orchestra. If you're happy, you can download the MP3 or print out the sheet music. If not, recompose and try again. Besides being tremendously fun, it's a great way to expose children to music and to teach music reading. It's for ages 6 and up, costs $20 at thinkfun.com. Hey Froggy from R&R Games. Too many frogs, not enough lily pads. Isn't life sometimes like that? The good news is that unlike the rest of life, the frogs can pile on top of each other. So you roll the dice to bounce colored, and they're red, blue, yellow, and green, frogs around the pond. You score points when the frogs on the top match the colors on the card in your hand. You'll need a little luck and a little strategy and extra points if you're able to eat some flies along the way. It's fun and it's quick, only takes 15 or 20 minutes to play for 2 to 4 players, ages 10 and up, and costs $15.95. You can get that at rnrgames.com. Mix Up, Fix Up from Wonder Forge. A fun logic and memory game for preschoolers, that's what this is. Players take turns being the patient. Without showing any of the other players, who are doctors, the patient takes an x-ray card that has 8 pictures of different medical tools, like a stethoscope, syringe, a thermometer, and there are different backgrounds, dots, checkerboards, hearts, flowers, or stripes, and there are different colors. So you slip that card into an x-ray sleeve, they call it, which has a window that shows only one of those tools. The doctors then flick a spinner, which tells them to either guess a pattern, a color, or a tool. For every wrong answer, the patient gets a bandage. The most bandages wins. It's kind of like Clue, but instead of Colonel Mustard in the parlor with a knife, it's the stethoscope on the yellow background with stripes. For 2 to 6 players ages 3 and up, little kids are going to have a ball at this, $15.99. And you can get it at wonderforge.com. Wink from Blue Orange Games. The goal of this game is for players to signal your secret partner with a wink or some other gesture without any of the other players knowing that you've connected. The rules imply that all the players have to agree on one gesture, but hey, who says you have to follow the rules? The gameplay involves cards, tokens, matches, and accusations. However, the real fun is in trying to forge those secret partnerships. It takes only 20 to 30 minutes to play and is absolutely impossible to get through without laughing. which makes identifying those secret signals even harder. For 4 to 8 players, 8 and up, costs $15.99, and you can get it at blueorangegames.com. You can get our reviews of a lot more toys and games that are great for parents and kids to do together at our website, parentsatplay.com. We'll be back next week with another Parents at Play segment or possibly an Ask Mr. Dad segment, but don't go anywhere quite yet because there's more positive parenting to come.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this from the MrDad.com radio network.
I'm in almost every school bus and classroom. You see me around the neighborhood, and you tell me that I'm a pretty good kid.
Well, I'm one out of every 5 children in America, and I'm struggling with hunger.
Please visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank for ways to help.
Every dollar you donate helps provide 8 meals for kids like me.
We are Feeding America, brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Hi there, welcome back to Positive Parenting. This is the second part of today's show, and I'm Armin Brott. Family law professor Martha Ertman has made a career out of combining things that most people would say don't go together. On the personal front, she's one of 3 parents, all gay, who are raising 1 beloved boy. That boy attends church on Sundays and lights Shabbat candles on Friday nights because Martha is Unitarian and her wife is Jewish. She spends each school year teaching courses about contracts and commercial law to University of Maryland law students, and she spends the summers on her front porch writing academic articles about the surprising and prominent and positive role that contracts play in family life. But her most ambitious effort is bringing all of those disparate elements together into a format that's meant to translate all of this new take on family law for readers outside of law school, and that would be us. In this part of today's show, we're going to be talking with Martha Ertman about her new book, and she's going to tell us a little bit about her own story, about how in her 40s, with the help of contracts and mini contracts, which she calls deals, she was able to put together her own family. And she's also going to tell us about how all kinds of people use all kinds of agreements to cobble together families of their own through reproductive technologies, adoption, cohabitation, and marriage. I'm Armin Brott. We'll start talking about how formal and informal contracts can shape all kinds of families when positive parenting continues right after this. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Martha Ertman, who's the author of Love's Promises, How Formal and Informal Contracts Shape All Kinds of Families. Martha, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I think a lot of people think of contracts having to do with marriage and family, usually limited to prenuptial agreements, where if you get a divorce within a certain amount of time or you know, whatever the restrictions are, you're not going to get any of my money. It's kind of what it comes down to.
Right. The myth is that love and contracts are opposites. And in fact, I think it's a myth that's very assiduously cultivated by both law and the wider culture. So a huge reason for writing the book was to let people know that not only are contracts and these mini contracts I call deals running through all parts of family life and family law, but also that it's often a good thing. Prenups are the example that always comes to mind. They're often really unfriendly, like, I want to keep all the donuts, I don't want to share anything with you. But in fact, especially when you think of parenthood, but in lots of other situations too, it's not having a contract, not talking about what you expect your relationship's going to be in relation to each other that can really create much more harm.
Yeah, and I think if you think about it, though, their contracts are all over the place. If you get married in a traditional ceremony, you promise to uphold and obey or whatever it is that you're promising to. And, you know, promise is a kind of a contract. And, you know, certainly if you are sending your kids to private school, you are signing a contract to be paying for a lot of stuff.
And, right, and I think when you even think of the beginning of romance, you think about mostly you might go out to dinner, and so you're like doing commercial things that involved enforceable agreements. But when you start getting serious, that's when you hire a moving van. That's when you, in fact, after you move in, you're on the lease together. You are on a credit card together. You join the health club together. So those are formal legal commercial contracts. But what happens is the law is in the background, and that's and family law is in the background to say once you be you're somebody that the law refers to, that I refer to as an us, that they refer to as a family, then you have these obligations to each other based on the promises you've made, either explicit, like I'm going to marry you, therefore we'll share what comes into the household, or implicit, that could take all sorts of different forms. I'm particularly interested in the back and forths that are super informal, often about kids, like you do the drop-off and I do the pickup from daycare, or you're really good at making sure that the vaccinations are all done, I'm happy to be the one coaching the teams. And different people have different strengths. They're not usually haggled agreements. They're often implicit. But if one person is doing everything, I think most people would say that's out of whack.
But even if it's not just doing everything, I mean, I think there are plenty of families, and I think I was in one for a while before I got divorced, where one person was doing a lot more keeping track of things and had in her mind a very different way of assessing what's fair. And,
right.
You know, so she had that. But I didn't know that because she wasn't telling me. And I suppose I had my own way of assessing what was fair, too. The two things were not the same. And, you know, I was assuming that she was buying into my contract and she was assuming that I'm buying into hers. But if you don't talk about them and put it all together into something workable, then you got problems.
Well, exactly. I think that's exactly right. And so, in fact, what I encourage family lawyers to do, and also just regular people, which is why it is so lovely to reach your listeners, is to stop thinking about contracts and these mini contracts I call deals as unfriendly. In fact, it's way more friendly to sit down and have a glass of wine or cappuccino and some Doritos and talk about what it is you hope for. What part are you thinking is going to work well? Where are your strengths? Where are your weaknesses? Instead of kind of crossing your fingers, closing your eyes, thinking it all should come naturally, but sweeping under the rug any difficulties. So there's a friend who read a draft of the book. I had lots of folks from lots of different life situations read a draft, and she said, "Oh, my husband does nothing. After I read a draft of your book, I said, I want you to share." He says, "Well, what do you do?" And she said, "Good question." And she made a list of everything she did in a given week. They have a bunch of children, so there was a lot to manage with bathing and feeding and everything else, and how long it took each thing. And she was surprised at how long it took, and he was surprised. And they looked at the list, and he said, "Wow, I had no idea. Tell me what I can take off your hands." So they wrote down, you know, 3, 4, 5 things, whatever it was, put that into his column. And then she was really happy about it. But I said, "That's great. So you put it away, and then in 6 months you can look at it again just to refresh." And she said, "No, we tore it up because we trust each other. Ooh. We don't need to have it in writing." And I think that's common, and it may be true for them. It may be true for everyone. But at least in my personal experience, having it in writing is a moment where you really are committing to it. And just because you share a bedroom and a bathroom doesn't mean you can read each other's minds.
Well, I mean, just as you were saying that, we trust each other, so we tore it up. I mean, everybody probably has some sort of a story about, "Oh, I wish I would have had that in writing before I shook hands on that deal," whatever
well,
it was.
And even if you never thought it was going to go before a judge. So I am hoping, I'm talking to lawyers around the country, as well as people who are never darkening the door of a lawyer's office. And my hope is that they'll see that it's worthwhile to talk about the little stuff. So I had a baby with a gay man. I'm a lesbian. I found myself 38 and single and thinking, how am I going to do this? I could have gone to a sperm bank. But I didn't. I really didn't want to do it all on my own. So I had a wonderful, dear old friend, and I called him up and asked him, "Do you want to have a baby?" And he said, "What do you have in mind?" And I kind of told him, and he said, "Let's keep talking." So we just kept talking, and little by little, it became clear that what we wanted to give and get as gay friends having a baby kind of fit together well. But because we were never lovers and never would be lovers, and because we're both law professors, it made sense to put down that we're going to split daycare, we're going to split college, that we, and the non-binding things that no court would enforce, which would be we were both single, we hoped we'd find sweethearts, and we promised to support each other's romantic relationships. So those are emotional terms. No court's going to get in the business of it. But in the inevitable moment where they, you know, people are looking at each other crosswise, you remember, you wrote it down. It remembers your better self. Something about that formality helps you in your future self to remember how full your heart was on the front end of the deal.
Now, when you're talking about these contracts, do you think that they, I don't know, that you both have to be in agreement, I guess, to do the contract in the first place? It's not something you can impose on somebody else?
Well, one of the things that's very interesting is there are a bunch of stories I tell. I wrote this to include a little bit of the memoir from my own life about these contracts and deals working out well. 11 years in, I'm happy to say things are going well. But also from most of it is about other families. So, for example, in open adoption, every single adoption is a contract. A contract is a legally enforceable agreement. There's no way that the adoption would even happen unless the birth parents formally agree to give up their parental rights and duties, and the adoptive parents formally agree to take them on. There's a myth that there's no such thing as an adoption contract. In fact, they happen all the time. We just call them other things. Where it works to have what I'm very interested in, post-adoption contract agreements, where after an adoption, the kid can still have some contact with the birth family, and the birth family can have some contact with the kid. It might just be letters, it could be emails, it might be visits, depending on what works for people. And that's where contract is great, because if both sides, both the adoptive family and the birth family, have enough in common that they can figure out a way to work together, they can really be in each other's lives in a really positive way. But where it doesn't work is where birth parents do not want to give this child up at all, really don't. I mean, no child parent does, but they really are resisting it tooth and nail. And the adoptive family wants it to be a totally closed adoption. In that situation, if they were to split the baby, as it were, and agree to some post-adoption contact, that doesn't work so well. What works is if people actually agree, which is where the talking is helpful. If you talk on the front end when you're dating, oh, you want to raise the children Orthodox, I didn't know that. You could maybe find out things that could short-circuit what could otherwise be a tremendous conflict.
Well, I want to ask you a quick question, though. We're coming up on a break, but about the, you just in the scenario you described, you've got the birth parents who don't want to give up. Doesn't that just end the whole thing right there? I mean, why are we continuing to talk about the couple that wants to take on the parental rights and responsibilities if the other guys aren't giving them up?
Because life is not perfect. This is the heartbreaking part. I have a term called Plan A and Plan B. Plan A is what happens most often. Genetic parents raise their kids, right? Plan B is what happens when law or luck or biology gets in the way. So if you're really young or addicted or really sick or have some other really impoverished and you can't raise the child, then somebody else will do it for you. And that's what adoption is. I really don't think there are many birth parents who would tell the story of, I really wanted to give up this child. Which is why 500,000 kids are languishing in foster care right now. So it's not a perfect world, but what contracts can come in to do is sort of make the best of a bad situation.
Right. Talking with Martha Ertman, who's the author of Love's Promises, How Formal and Informal Contracts Shape All Kinds of Families. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll keep talking to Martha Ertman. Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Martha Ertman, who's the author of Love's Promises, How Formal and Informal Contracts Shape All Kinds of Families. Martha, you talk about Plan A and Plan B, and Plan A being pretty much
the normal situation of a biologically related couple having a biologically related child, and then Plan B being everything else. Talk a little bit about the depth and breadth of what Plan B is.
Right. Plan B is in the Family Law parts of the book. I have the whole first half of the book is about Plan B parenthood. So the one common way that people can try to have a child when the fun-free stuff around the house doesn't end in that situation is to go through reproductive technology. I focus on alternative insemination because that's where legal issues are more likely to come up. And about 40,000 babies are born in the United States every year via alternative insemination. Some of the genetic dads are also social dads and legal dads. And some of those genetic dads, probably the vast majority of them, are just genetic dads. The sperm comes through a sperm bank, and they probably don't have contact with the children, although increasingly they're finding each other through the internet. The other main method of becoming a Plan B parent is through adoption. It's much more common. 2.5% of all children in the United States are adopted, so that's an immense number. It's certainly not majority, but it's lots of, by a long shot, but it's lots and lots of people. And because adoptions come up with kids, about a ton of them are step-parent adoptions, then contracts, and particularly open adoption agreements, began to be accepted through that step-parent situation. So a spouse who has custody has a new spouse, and then there can be an adoption by the new spouse without totally cutting off that other biological parent. And I think that's a really positive outcome that increasingly states are recognizing as legally binding.
So they're recognizing three parents then?
They are. And in fact, to formally recognize three parents, three full throttle parents, at three people deciding religion, three people deciding vaccinations, three people deciding, you know, how old is old enough to chew gum, that is pretty rare. Just a tiny handful of states are recognizing that, one of which is California. And even then, in really limited circumstances. My situation, where I'm raising a child with a friend, and he's been in the game since our son was born, and then I have a wife, that really is three people involved in a way that is much more than most people are. Usually it's involved for a tiny purpose, which is, emails on occasion, visits very occasionally. But the lovely thing about contracts is you can tailor it. So love comes in different packages, parenthood comes in different packages, and you can tailor the package using these agreements so that the people you think of as family are also treated as family by your social group and also,
right,
in many situations, by the law.
Now, you mentioned alternative insemination. Do you consider donor eggs in that category, or is that something separate?
That's a different one. It's interesting that I picked alternative insemination and talk about donor eggs, and I tell some wonderful stories about how the donors of those eggs feel and how they feel quite different than the donors of sperm, interestingly. And the industries are very different. It's a $3 billion a year industry of reproductive technology. The donors of eggs are very, very rarely involved in the child's life. Sometimes the donors of sperm are, and I think what's so interesting is that when the people who research this, Renee Ameling at Yale wrote a wonderful book on this, when she talked to egg donors, they said, "I am not a mother," that only a monster would sell her child. When you ask the guys whether they're dads, they kind of shrug. They say, "Well, I wasn't really thinking about it when I was selling my sperm to get through school, but if push comes to shove, I guess I am kind of a dad." So even though the roles are the same, they're each contributing half of the genetic material, the views of the donors are quite different.
It's really odd, I think, that there wouldn't be the same sort of thing. I would have thought it would be the other way around.
that the moms would think of themselves as moms.
Yeah.
Probably because it's so interesting. It's really social. So there's a part of it that's biological, and then there's a part of parenthood, of course, that's deeply social. And it's that we think of motherhood as so altruistic and giving, so that very often the recipients of donor eggs will give an egg donor a gift after the whole transaction has finished up. That never happens with sperm donors. It's so interesting. You can, yeah. If you were to go online, if your listeners went online and they Googled sperm bank, they'd probably pull up the California Cryobank. They would be able to get an inventory of donors with tons of information, but you will not get adult pictures. With the egg, you can get children's pictures and audio tapes of what their voice sounds like and so forth, all for a price. But with the egg donors, you find out where they went to school. You get pictures of them as adults. You see pictures of them with their family. You know their name. So it's just a very different side. And the why of it, I think, is largely cultural.
It's weird, I think. I mean, because, you know, if you think about it really and truly from a biological point of view, the eggs and the sperm are equally responsible for however the child grows up, right?
Or exactly. At least, so it's a puzzle.
It's weird.
It's because I think we expect so much more from mothers.
Yeah.
That women still are mostly doing most of the caregiving in households that keep things running smoothly. And so I think that, at least in my personal experience, it's the very first time I had an experience where to be a good mother lined up with being a good woman, lined up with being a good person. And I had never had that experience. So if you're a bad mother, I think often you feel like a bad person and a bad woman. And I think guys just have a little more slack. That one of the lovely things about having a baby with a gay man is we can kind of compare and contrast. And he has a different experience. In his experience, he says competence seems to be like you want to be a good dad and a good role model.
Exactly.
But it's not it's. And I think that's all right, that in fact it would be odd if we were doing the same jobs. And that in fact, I think that what I have come to believe in writing this book is the most important thing is connection. And because social connections are so important, we get them in all kinds of different ways. And we get different things from one parent than from another parent.
Martha, we're kind of running out of time, but I want to take us quick back to contracts. Give us a couple of pitfalls that we need to be looking out for if you're thinking of doing a contract with somebody that you're involved with.
Yes, if you're doing a contract, let's say if you're like me and you're thinking of having a baby with a friend, take a look at the back of my book. There is a contract that was also used by another lesbian and gay man to have a kid, but oftentimes straight women and gay guys are having these having kids together. Don't take the chance of having different views. Too often, I think sometimes a woman will ask a man for the sperm. He has one assumption that he's going to be the dad. She has another assumption that he's going to be a sperm donor. And then the baby's born, and she just takes the sperm and runs. And I think that's bad for the dad, and I think it's bad for the kid. And they should be thinking of contracts as friendly. It's a friendly thing. It's a loving thing to sit down and say who you are to each other. And what's unfriendly is just thinking, oh my goodness, our relationship couldn't possibly last if we were to talk about what our situation is.
How much of that's enforceable?
Well, this is the thing. Some of it will be, some of it's not. When you have kids, there's going to be a general principle that the public policy of protecting kids is going to trump whatever the parents want. So it's different from buying a Slurpee at 7-Eleven. But, of course, employment contracts are different from buying a Slurpee at 7-Eleven. You can't work for under minimum wage. So a lot of it would not be enforceable, maybe. But the thing is, I think most people, in my experience and in my research as well, most people want to be the kind of person who honors their promises. And so if you promise, like I promised with my friend, he was going to be a dad, there were moments where that may not have been convenient, and I just remembered my promise, and it's ended up being far better in the long run. But, of course, I have made a career out of writing about family promises, so I really can't break them and keep my head up.
Martha Ertmans, the author of Love's Promises, How Formal and Informal Contracts Shape All Kinds of Families. Martha, great to have you. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.